Yemen's crisis up close today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The United Nations says war and famine have turned Yemen into the worst humanitarian crisis on Earth. Then last year, cholera broke out too. This Red Cross official saw the impact just outside a hospital.
I saw a guy who had an IV fluid bag pouch sort of hanging from the window of his car because he couldn't get access into it. This outbreak went like bushfire. It was really surprising. I never saw that before.
Also, what it's like to cross one of the thickest jungles in the Americas.
I start to feel sometimes that I don't know what I can do if I'm lost. If I get lost, I'm going to die.
Plus, what stars would sound like if we could hear them. Those stories and more coming up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for joining us. We start on the golf course, symbolically speaking anyway, because today President Donald Trump meets with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe in Florida, the start of a two-day retreat for the leaders at Mar-a-Lago. Both men are avid golfers. They've played together at Trump's club and in Japan. But this time, the mood, the agenda, and what's domestically on both men's plates, it all looks very different. Earlier today, I spoke with Motoko Rich, the Tokyo bureau chief for The New York Times, and I asked her about what Trump and Abe are planning to get done.
Well, their original purpose was, as you may remember, Donald Trump surprised the world when he announced that he had accepted an invitation from North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un to go meet him somewhere and speak with him. And immediately after hearing this news, Prime Minister Abe decided he needed to get to Washington and talk to Trump to make sure that the agenda that they had previously been kind of walking lockstep in, which was to continue to apply pressure to North Korea to urge the regime to denuclearize, was still in place. So that was the original reason why he wanted to go. Obviously, as with every day of this administration, a number of other events have occurred, including the fact that Japan did not get an exemption from these steel and aluminum tariffs that Donald Trump announced. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, from which Donald Trump withdrew the United States within his first week of taking office, the 11 remaining countries signed an agreement. And then fairly recently, Donald Trump said he wanted to reopen it and see if he could reconsider U.S. joining. So there's a lot on their plates now to discuss.
Yeah, North Korea and TPP could easily take up all the time of the 2 days. On North Korea, what are Abe's hopes and concerns about the meeting, the proposed meeting between Trump and Kim Jong-un next month or in June?
Sure. I mean, I think the biggest concern for Abe and Japan in general is this notion that if the two leaders are discussing, you know, give and take and possible compromises, that the deal might compromise the security of Japan. So Japan has long been well within the range of ballistic missiles that could fly from North Korea and attack Japan for many years. It's only very recently that North Korea has developed an intercontinental ballistic missile that could potentially reach the continental United States. So the concern is that perhaps in these discussions, the agreement might be that North Korea has to give up its ICBM, but not its shorter and medium range missiles, which would still reach Japan. And so Japan would then feel very insecure that a deal had been reached that kind of left them out in the cold.
And on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, I mean, there was Trump's initial desire to pull out of it, then this tantalizing proposal that maybe the U.S. will get back into it. How much do you think Abe is going to try and convince Trump to rejoin the TPP?
I think he's probably going to push him pretty hard. I mean, this is something that Japan wants, and they know that there are other countries in the region that want it, that signed onto the deal originally because they thought they were going to get access to U.S. markets. That being said, the prime minister has said that they do not want to renegotiate the deal. So when the president says things like, I'll consider coming back in if I can get a better deal, that's when Japan starts to get a little bit anxious.
So behind these two world leaders, we've got all sorts of stories going on at the moment. Both of them are on the ropes. Trump is dealing with a long list of things, a shady lawyer, the former head of the FBI taking him down, the Russia investigation, and more. Meantime, in Tokyo, there are protesters in front of the parliament, the Diet, some calling for Abe's resignation. What problems domestically is Abe dealing with?
Right. Well, so he's dealing with scandals of his own. There aren't nearly as many of them, nor do they seem quite as dramatic as what we're seeing in the United States. But here in Tokyo, this has been a big deal for quite a long time. So for the better part of a year, there was sort of this back and forth over two issues. One was this right-wing school based in Osaka that had bought some public land at a steeply, like 85% discounted price. And there was a question of whether, since Mr. Abe's wife, Akie Abe, was going to be on the board of a new school that was being built by the school group, whether or not there was some kind of connection between her influence and that discount. Then there was another case in which a friend of Abe's was granted permission to open a new veterinary school. And there was a question of whether he had also improperly gotten that deal because of his connections with the prime minister. So I think it's causing a lot of trouble. And his public opinion ratings have fallen so low that they're now below Donald Trump's.
Yeah, I mean, his poll numbers are at rock bottom. I guess Trump might be able to gloat a little bit about that. Motoko Rich, the Tokyo bureau chief for The New York Times, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alexandre Fett spent the last 2 years trying to save lives in the middle of a civil war. And recently, he said goodbye to his staff.
Well, it was a very mixed feelings. I was very sad to leave after those two tremendous years, extremely intense, where so much happened.
Fett is talking about the civil war in Yemen. He's the outgoing head of operations there for the International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC. The conflict in Yemen has killed more than 10,000 people and shows no signs of stopping. The U.S. has been throwing its weight behind one side in the war, the side backed by Saudi Arabia. In fact, Fett was in Washington today to tell U.S. authorities about the dire conditions caused by the war. His last day of work in Yemen was April 1st.
And I was sad to leave friends behind, those people that work with me. Yemeni people are extremely warm, and they made me feel welcome in their country. Now, I was also sad not only because I was leaving them, I was sad because the country is not in a good shape. The 2 years that I spent in Yemen, I saw the country going down and down, and this is a very worrying idea for me.
What you describe could be the situation in Syria. We've seen kind of the plight of the Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar, the Yazidi in northern Iraq. What makes Yemen different?
Look, I've been in the ICRC for 22 years, and really, for me, Yemen was different in one particular dimension. In Yemen, you have an infrastructure which is quite significant. It's not the most modern country in the world, but it's quite developed. And I'm very worried that these structures are really sort of falling into pieces. And the best example of this, I suppose, is, you know, the cholera crisis of last year, where you had a million accumulated suspected cases of cholera and acute watery diarrhea and 2,000 people who died as a result. In a country like Yemen, this is totally unprecedented and quite a negative sign.
Yeah, so let's talk about that cholera outbreak, because that was pretty shocking. A million Yemenis infected, and we were hearing that hospitals couldn't keep up with treatment and patients were getting drip feeds in the parking lots of hospitals. The hospitals were so crowded. What did you see?
Well, actually, I saw that. I was physically present and I saw a guy who had an IV fluid bag pouch sort of hanging from the window of his car because he couldn't get access into it. This outbreak went like bushfire. It was really surprising. I never saw that before. And this is a testimony to this, you know, system that stops functioning.
I mean, one out of every 25 people there got sick, which if you translate that to American numbers, it'd be like 15 million Americans getting cholera. So in the middle of bombing and this conflict, what challenges did the ICRC face dealing with this outbreak?
Well, it was something additional. We were already pretty busy with the sort of direct effect of the hostilities, and all of a sudden you have this that arrives, you know, like from nowhere, basically. When we had two or three cases of cholera, I said, not so good. And then it went like bang, you know. And then that's the problem, because it comes on top of the rest. And you have to tell your staff, okay, guys, we are going to get some reinforcement from Geneva, but, you know, make no mistake, they're not there tomorrow. We need to identify them. We need to extract them possibly from other missions and so on. So, you know, you guys need to work a bit more and a bit more, you know, ends to be a lot more.
So kind of not immediate response. The urgency was a little lacking, it sounds like, from Geneva. Also, Syria going on in the background and so many other conflicts, and Yemen really feels like it's not on the front page and rarely has been. Does it make you angry?
Look, when you are in charge of a particular operation, you would always want to have more resources, more people, and so on. I think I cannot blame my colleagues in Geneva. They did a great work, especially logistics. They, you know, we had a rotation of Ilyushins. Those huge, you know, Russian cargo planes arrived on the airports. No, they did a great work, and they also worked very, very hard. Now, it's true. What you say is correct, that a conflict like Syria has drawn more attention for whatever reason. But I have to say that this level of attention is increasing, and this is quite heartening.
But if we pull back and we look and see that the United States has chosen to back one party in the Yemen civil war, the party led by the former Yemeni president, and we've heard from many observers that U.S. support for that side is helping to actually prolong the war, what does the ICRC say to outside powers like the U.S.?
Look, in the an armed conflict is never a pleasant sort of affair. But what is important is that international humanitarian law, known as IHL, so the law of war, is respected. That civilians are protected, civilians are not made the object of an attack. And this is what we have been saying. I'm here today in Washington, and I have to say we had very constructive discussions with a representative of the U.S. authorities who were very, very keen to listen and have this interaction with us and with myself after those 2 years. Very, very good discussions.
Were you talking to the State Department?
We spoke to the State Department. I went to the Pentagon for the first time in my life. We saw, you know, all the representatives from the U.S. government that have an interest in knowing what's going on. And it's indeed after 2 years being in Sana'a, seeing things firsthand and so on, you know, I was trying to bring a very close perspective and trying to explain how we saw things and what value, added value, the U.S. government may have. Very interesting, very constructive discussion, I have to say.
What was that like for you, being inside the Pentagon for the first time as a humanitarian kind of worker? Were they listening to you?
It was very long. I saw a very high level panel of a U.S. representative, both civilian and military, which really shows how keen they were to listen. You know, high-ranking military, they were very keen to listen to the first-hand account of what's going on in Yemen. As a European, you hear about the Pentagon, and it's so much of a symbol of the United States, as well as the White House and others, I suppose. And being inside, I have to say, yes, it's quite impressive.
So as you've seen the arc of the war in Yemen for the last 2 years and this most recent experience at the Pentagon and everything else you've been telling me, Alexandre, do you see any glimmer of hope that the conflict can end?
Look, once again, on the political line, we are not in the driving seat. But what I have seen recently is that the new special envoy, Mr. Griffiths, special envoy of the Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Griffiths, had meaningful discussions. Whether those discussions are going to lead somewhere, this I don't know. Because we are not sure that a peace deal may be around the corner, this is all the more important that international law of armed conflict is respected in the meantime, and that a special effort is made to deal with those humanitarian effects of the conflict, such as cholera that we just spoke about, the provision of water, and that sort of things.
Alexandre Fett, now the former director of the ICRC in Yemen, joining us from Washington. Thanks so much for your time. Good luck.
Thank you very much indeed.
Coming up in just a bit on the show, a telescope that not only looks at the stars, but listens to them as well. That's here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. In a moment, what it's like crossing on foot through one of the least hospitable stretches of jungle in the Americas. But first, let me take a minute to tell you about a story on tomorrow's show. It's about one of the women who first spoke out against the abuses of Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein. Asia Argento, the well-known Italian actress, and also the most prominent voice of the Me Too movement in Italy. But then came the backlash. Argento was vilified by many Italians. She was even blamed for the sexual assault she suffered. Argento calls it a character assassination.
All the other victims coming from the States with the same predator were not assassinated in their character the way I was. So I know that it's because of me and because of what I've been, you know, free with my word, free with my body, free as a woman, free to say what I want, and unafraid to break this stereotype of the silent bourgeois actress who's submitted toward the male-dominated film world in Italy.
We'll hear more from Italian actress Asia Argento tomorrow on the show. It is possible to drive from the Arctic Ocean all the way south across the Americas to Tierra del Fuego, but you will have one major obstacle at the legendary Darien Gap. That's where Central and South America meet, a huge area of jungle on the border of Panama and Colombia. It's the only break in the Pan-American Highway. The road ends. It is literally a gap. So the only way to cross is by foot and by boat. But this did not deter my colleague Alejandro Millán with BBC Mundo. Since he was a kid, he's dreamed of venturing across the Darien Gap and documenting it for radio.
I have this special fascination with Darien Gap because I was born in Medellin. That's the closest Colombian city to the Darien Gap. I grew up listening to the stories about the jungle, and I want to go to find the people who live there, the rivers, what happened there. But this region was very dangerous in the past. It was controlled by the FARC, the guerrilla group. But after they signed the peace agreement, well, we find an opportunity to go.
Nosotros nos vamos a adentrar donde muy pocos periodistas se han metido. Queremos saber quiénes habitan el tapón. Porque algunos dicen que es el lugar más peligroso e inhóspito de América Latina.
My journey started in the town of Yaviza. Yaviza is a Panamanian city where the Pan-American Highway is interrupted. And the only way to continue the trip was by boat, by the river.
Hace unas tres horas y media salimos de Yaviza. Dejamos ya atrás el Real. Ahora estamos navegando sobre el río Tuira.
When I start to interview the people, they told me that the water for them was very important. They have two seasons, the wet season and the dry seasons. When they have this wet season, they have a river. But when they don't have the rain, they have a lot of difficulties to transport their goods. When I went to the Darien Gap, we have some difficulties to navigate through the river. Sometimes I have to get out of the boat, walking over the river, and push out because we can't continue the trip.
Nos tocó bajarnos a empujar la piragua porque estamos en una zona bastante seca.
When I start to visit the towns there, Boca de Cupe, Paya is an indigenous place, I found two ways to understand the Darien Gap. One way is they want to develop the Pan-American route, to continue the highway through the jungle. They need to transport their goods because it's very difficult for them. And the other group, they wanted to protect the jungle. And this group, mainly, they were the indigenous group. We don't want to lose our food, our water, our trees. They are very important for us. They are the groups confront in the middle of the jungle about this Pan-American highway. After we left the river, the fallen trees, the impenetrable vegetation is very difficult to get through. I like to say that I was on holidays by the river and I went to the nightmare through the jungle. I expect to be there like 6 hours, but we spent like 12 hours there. It was very difficult. We don't have any GPS. I don't have any clocks. I don't have any way to know where I am. And this is a very disturbing feeling. I trust in my guy, a man from there, who told me what to do. But I start to feel sometimes that I don't know what I can do if I'm lost. If I get lost, I'm going to die. Another thing is that you don't see the sun. Anytime. You feel the sun. You feel the heat. But you can't see the sun because the trees is everywhere. So they cover me. No, it's impossible.
Sigue sintiéndose la inclemencia del tapón del Darién. Está haciendo por lo menos 30 grados. Así que esto es una combinación de humedad y calor todo el tiempo, permanente.
So we walk in like 4 hours. We get to the border between Colombia and Panama. You don't find a policeman or someone who's going to check your passport, no. You find construction, one side says Panama, the other side says Colombia, and it's kind of in the middle, nowhere. We get some rest there, and after that we start walking again with the hope we are going to be in a better place. But no, we start to get into the mud. When I get a step, I fall down into the mud. After 8 hours, I start to have some hallucinations. I start to see things that are not there. It was crazy. I have to say that I underestimate the jungle. At the end of the nightmare, the end of this journey, I have a picture. It's me looking to the camera, covered by mud, and the expression is, I don't know what just happened to me. I don't know. And that expression in my face explains everything. It's like near to death. That's exactly the definition that what happened to me at the end of this day.
Don't underestimate the jungle. That's the BBC's Alejandro Millán after living his dream to cross the Darién Gap, that stretch of jungle along the border between Colombia and Panama. He shared his story on the BBC's Fifth Floor podcast. I'm Marco Werman. Secretary of State nominee Mike Pompeo has blown hot and cold on climate change. In 2013, he said this.
There are scientists that think lots of different things about climate change. There's some who think we're warming. There's some who think we're cooling.
And here's Pompeo last week.
I also believe that the climate is changing, that there's a warming taking place. I'm happy to concede that there is likely a human component to that.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Next week, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee is expected to vote on the nomination of Mike Pompeo to be the new Secretary of State. If the current CIA director and former Kansas congressman is confirmed, he'll have a lot on his plate. Syria, Russia, North Korea, just to name a few places. But Pompeo's also getting attention from environmentalists for his views on climate change. The World's Livable Planet reporter Carolyn Beeler is here with me to talk about this. Carolyn, what is Pompeo's record on climate change?
Well, Marco, he's long been known as a skeptic of climate science. And when he was a congressman for Kansas, he stood up against U.S. federal government efforts to regulate carbon emissions and efforts to spur renewable energy development. He's also one of the biggest all-time recipients of campaign funds from the Koch brothers, the billionaire oil tycoons. Here's what he said in a C-SPAN interview in 2013 when he was asked if he thought global warming was a problem.
There are scientists that think lots of different things about climate change. There's some who think we're warming. There's some who think we're cooling. There's some who think that the last 16 years have shown a pretty stable climate environment.
So this is a pretty standard line, obfuscating the scientific truth on this. But at his Senate confirmation hearing last week, Pompeo did walk back these comments a little bit.
I also believe that the climate is changing, that there's a warming taking place. I'm happy to concede that there is likely a human component to that. And I'm equally prepared to tell you that as we find tools that are effective to prevent the risk to the United States, that a national security challenge, the State Department ought to appropriately be involved in them.
That statement did get some attention last week, but it's not really seen as any major reversal on Pompeo's behalf, more a sort of softening of rhetoric that cabinet nominees often make when they're going in front of a committee to get confirmed.
Right. So what is the context here? Like, where does the Trump cabinet currently stand on climate change? How would Pompeo fit in?
This is sort of the latest sign that the Trump administration is becoming increasingly entrenched in its climate change policies, its climate skepticism. Most of the president's top-level advisors either decline to acknowledge that climate change is happening or say that there are big questions about how much humans actually are influencing a change in climate. Rex Tillerson, who Pompeo would be replacing if he is indeed confirmed, was seen as a big moderating influence on President Trump. He urged him to stay in the Paris Climate Change Agreement, where all countries in the world agreed to limit carbon emissions, as sort of a diplomatic move. He's obviously out of the White House, as are two other key advisors who also urged Trump to stay in the Paris Agreement, who both have left in the past few months.
So who's left in the White House that isn't a climate skeptic?
Defense Secretary Jim Mattis is probably the highest profile person who accepts the science of climate change and thinks the U.S. government should be doing something about it. He said it is a threat to U.S. national security and argues that the Defense Department should be planning with climate change in mind when it plans for the future.
Yeah, so if most of Trump's cabinet does not believe that humans are the primary drivers of climate change, what does it matter if the Secretary of State holds the same views?
So just because the U.S. federal government doesn't seem to care much about climate change these days doesn't mean the rest of the world doesn't. So Pompeo, if he's confirmed, is going to be having conversations with world leaders and diplomats about how climate change might be impacting national security or cross-border migration or foreign aid. So his views on climate change will influence how he does his job, which is something that came up in the Senate confirmation hearing last week. On top of that, the State Department is in charge of the U.S.'s involvement in these ongoing UN climate talks. Now, the U.S. has said they're going to be out, but they can't actually pull out until 2020. So they're continuing to send people to these talks, and they are expected to send a delegation to an important meeting at the end of this year where the world community will come up with what's called the rule book for the Paris Agreement. So Pompeo, if he's confirmed, will have a role in what kind of presence the U.S. will have there.
Yeah, and these American groups can't just go to these conferences and say, we're not listening. Where does Pompeo's nomination stand right now? And has climate change even been a factor in his confirmation hearings?
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee hopes to vote on Pompeo next week. It's looking increasingly likely that he might not have the votes in that committee, not really because of climate change, but because of stances on other issues. But Republican leaders are still saying that they'll call for a vote in the full Senate, and they think he might be able to be confirmed. So that would be pretty rare for that to happen, but it might well. So stay tuned.
Yeah, we'll keep watching. The World's Livable Planet reporter, Carolyn Beeler. Thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
Here on The World, we often tell stories about people on the move looking for a better life. So here now is a story about a runner with a big dream. He made the journey from Eritrea all the way to Israel to try to make it happen. Here's Shayna Sheely with his story.
Tekleet Michael started running with Eritrea's fastest athletes when he was just 14 years old. His plan? To compete in the 2012 London Olympics. Tekleet burned through a pair of sneakers nearly every month, so he went to work at a government textile factory to pay for them. One day, after hours of labor, he went to collect his earnings. He says his supervisor, a government employee, refused to pay him. When Tekleet pushed back, the man threatened him.
And he told me, you are a son of a bitch and you are talking against the government.
And in Eritrea, Tekleet says, the punishment for speaking against the government is often prison. The military dictatorship there is considered among the most repressive governments in the world. Tekleet decided to quit his job, but one day after practice, his running coach pulled him aside.
He told me, you're born to run.
Whatever happens, he said,
don't stop running.
Looking back on that moment, Tekleet thinks his coach knew he might get arrested.
He knew that there is something wrong in the country. He knew that something can happen.
A few months later, the police approached Tekleet and accused him of questioning the government.
And I'm just put on the government.
They handcuffed him and put him in a dirty, crowded prison cell. Tekleet says he was routinely dragged out of it and kicked and beaten. But even in his cell, he continued to train. The other prisoners made room for him while he did jumping jacks and jogged in place.
They gave me space, like 2 or 1 meter, just to jog and just my leg in one place. Up, down, up, down.
After nearly a year of detention, Tikrit decided to escape. He and another prisoner jumped a fence at night and sprinted into the darkness. When they reached the Sudanese border 3 days later, Eritrean soldiers tried to arrest them.
So we decided to run.
And they ran. The soldiers shot at them. Bullets hit the ground and dust flew up around Tikrit's ankles.
At that time, I was thinking like, not my legs. Because I was thinking about my dream. It's still running. If you hit my legs, my dream is over. Please don't hit my legs.
He ran all day.
Not like slow walk, you know. I cover in one day around 100 kilometers.
100 kilometers. He and his friend got separated. When Tikrit finally made it to the capital, Khartoum, he walked to a massive open-air stadium. It was empty. But he stepped onto the track and he ran.
I was imagining like countless people to cheer and to give you support. It reminds you that you are a special person, you are a human being. You are not just a person searching to live or searching to survive, you know?
For the first time since he was dumped in prison, Tikrit says he felt human again. But then it was back to survival mode because the Sudanese government was arresting and deporting Eritreans, thousands of them. Tikrit paid smugglers to get him to Egypt and across the Sinai Desert. There, he pulled himself over the border fence into Israel's Negev Desert.
Yeah, climbed the fence.
And he made his way to Tel Aviv. His first job, sweeping floors in a 10-story parking garage.
And I used to run in the stairs.
He ran, wherever he could. One day, he was spotted by a coach from the Israeli national team. The coach told Tikrit he had the potential to run professionally and invited him to train with the team. He brought Tikrit new shoes and jerseys.
Like, what can I say? Like, this was my dream also, from the beginning, to have a manager and to compete competitions and, like, to get a shoes. You know, your entire dream. It's not just about the prize, or it's not about the money, it's not about the medal.
Tikrit's Olympic dreams were back on track. But there was a problem. He had no passport.
To be in that level, you have to have at least travel document. I don't have any document because I don't have any government that represents me. I'm a stateless person. So I'm out of the system.
And he didn't have much hope of that changing. Out of more than 35,000 African migrants who have arrived in Israel since 2009, just 11 have received asylum. Tikrit says his coach had one final idea, a long shot. His coach told him that if he converted to Judaism, he might have a chance at citizenship. Tikrit says he went to church to think about the option.
And I went to the church. I was completely broken.
When he stood up, he said no. He was Eritrean and an Orthodox Christian. He says converting felt like betraying his identity.
And I say to myself, there is no more running, no more sport.
Tikrit gave up running.
When I stopped training, that one thing came to my mind, okay, like, I have to shift my thinking. Not just to cry all the time about it, or just cry about the stuff, but to do it in more meaningful things, but to have other vision.
His other vision? To help his fellow Eritreans in Israel. Tikrit now works as an advocate at the Eritrean Community Center in South Tel Aviv.
Now we are here in Eritrean Women Community Center. You can see the people getting services.
In the past few years, he's spoken out against Israeli policies targeting undocumented asylum seekers from African countries. The government plans to forcibly deport them over the next 2 years. 2 weeks ago, the Israeli Prime Minister announced a deal with the United Nations to resettle some African asylum seekers in the West and give others temporary papers to stay in Israel.
It's a good agreement. I'm very glad that we achieved it with the UN Commissioner on refugees. It enables us to solve this problem.
Tikrit told me that he was feeling more optimistic than he had in years. But a day later, the Prime Minister canceled the deal. Tikrit now says he doesn't trust any government anymore. Every government has betrayed him. For The World, Shaina Sheely, Tel Aviv.
Betrayal by one's government is something many immigrants from the Caribbean in Britain are feeling right now. We're talking people who arrived shortly after World War II up through the early 1970s. Thousands of Jamaicans, Trinidadians, and other people from Caribbean islands who came to the UK to work. They're called the Windrush Generation because the first ship that arrived in the UK with those immigrants was called the Empire Windrush. Through the decades, these people set down roots in Britain. They were cleaners, drivers, and nurses. In 1971, the British government said that those immigrants could stay, even if the countries they came from had become independent. But now their legal status is up in the air. The British government has said that because many of these immigrants don't have the proper paperwork, they may be subject to deportation. Member of Parliament David Lammy, himself a child of Windrush parents, blamed the move on the rise of anti-immigrant rhetoric in Brexit Britain.
This is a day of national shame, and it has come about because of a hostile environment policy that was begun under her Prime Minister. Let us call it as it is. If you lay down with dogs, you get fleas, and that is what has happened with this far-right rhetoric in this country.
But British Prime Minister Theresa May tried to calm anger and worry that Commonwealth citizens, those mainly from former British colonies, were being singled out.
I want to dispel any impression that my government is in some sense clamping down on Commonwealth citizens, particularly those in the Caribbean who built a life here. I take this issue very seriously, and I want to apologise to you today.
It's all back in the news this week because the Guardian newspaper in London has been reporting just how consequential Britain's changed immigration rules have been on people's lives. Our producer in London, Leo Hornack, has been following the story.
What's quite shocking is that this kind of went unnoticed by the political class and the media for so long, because many of these people are people who are kind of undocumented, if you like, who didn't think it mattered they're undocumented. And once they realized it mattered, they were keeping their heads down. So it could be thousands of people. No one really knows how
was
many people it
deported?
Is.
Was anybody deported?
We don't, that, again, hasn't been confirmed, but just today, someone who was under threat of deportation because of this problem had basically his case put on hold to be re-examined. And that's purely because of the media attention that's now coming into it. Why is this only emerging now? I think that's a sign of basically how a lot of these people, just as in the States, the undocumented population is shying away from the limelight. And that means when people shy away from the limelight, really, really drastic and quite terrible things can happen in their lives through bureaucratic processes and no one even notices. So that goes for deportations. That goes for being denied healthcare. That goes for losing your job.
Here's an example of how serious the consequences can be. Michael Braithwaite moved from Barbados to Britain in the early 1960s when he was 9 years old. A few years ago, he lost his job as a teaching assistant for kids with special needs because he couldn't improve his immigration status.
I felt the pieces inside. I didn't actually, show it externally until I came home. I sat and I cried. My whole life sunk right down to my feet. It was distraught. I was distraught. 2 years, I think I've rationalized a lot of things inside myself, basically.
You can hear how painful it is to be part of the collateral damage. If you thought the MP we heard from a moment ago, David Lammy, was angry about the news about the Windrush generation, perhaps Mr. Braithwaite's story explains why. Here's a sound the Russian government doesn't want its citizens to ever hear again. That ping is the sound the popular messaging platform Telegram makes when users send or receive a text. You may remember a few weeks back we told you how the Russian government was moving to block the platform in the country, and this week the Kremlin started implementing that ban. For more on what this means, we've got the world's Charles Maines on the line from Moscow. So why is the Kremlin blocking Telegram, Charles? Let's start there.
Well, you know, this gets back, Marco, to this refusal by Telegram to hand over its encryption keys to its messaging service to the Russian authorities. Telegram provides end-to-end encryption for messaging, so all your chats are private. And the Russian government says this is about security for them, particularly the FSB. This is the successor agency to the KGB. You know, they say that Telegram is used by terrorists as a back channel for planning attacks and things like that. Now, the owner and founder of Telegram, a guy named, by the name of Pavel Durov, he says this is about privacy. He's called this block unconstitutional, and he's promised to help users get around the ban in various ways, to help them, you know, essentially keep their right to privacy. So it's become this real showdown in the debate of security versus privacy, something, of course, we know very well in the U.S. as well.
Yeah.
And it has a uniquely Russian angle to it, though, because Durov, the founder, is Russian. And he's had these battles over these issues with the Russian security services in the past. So clearly the Russian government doesn't want Telegram to set a precedent here that companies can ignore these rules and get away with it.
How is the implementation of the ban going so far?
Well, you know, despite this ban, Durov says that they hadn't seen any significant drop in user engagement. All day I've been checking personally and everything seems to be working fine. In fact, I'm just turning on my Telegram and there we go. It just started up.
So if Telegram is working, then what's the big deal?
Well, first of all, let me just turn off my Telegram and then we'll get started with that. And Telegram is working, as you can hear. But in trying to cut off its access in Russia, Roskomnadzor, this is the internet governing body here, they kind of botched the job. So in trying to root out Telegram, they also rooted out millions of other IP addresses that are all now blocked. Oh, sorry. And estimates that 4 to 16 million IP addresses, mostly tied to Amazon and Google sub-addresses, this gets more into internet speak, but you know the fact is that it's had this effect of disrupting all sorts of services from retailers to online gaming services to even other messaging apps like Viper that rely on these, some of these services from Google and Amazon. Now, I should say that the Russian internet governing body says that they contacted Amazon and Google beforehand to warn them that this might happen. But there are real concerns here that, you know, under government orders, Apple and Google may pull Telegram from their Russian app stores. So we'll just have to see.
And what about average Russians, like the people who use Telegram and others? I mean, what are their concerns right now? What are they saying?
Well, you know, Durov's kind of a hero to younger Russians. He's 33 years old. He's very successful. He's known as the Mark Zuckerberg of Russia, something we've covered in the past. And, you know, certainly yeah. In the tech and startup industry world in Russia, they're all on Durov's side. But they're also really upset because, you know, Durov is the kind of homegrown talent that Russia and its government, they think, should help nurture, not attack. And he's built a company now twice that it's built on ideas and talent. And not on, you know, oil and gas and natural resources, which is what most of the Russian economy is based on. So just to give you a sense of kind of the chatter among the tech industry here, I wanted to introduce you to Andrei Mima. Mima once worked with Durov in his old company, a company called Vkontakte. And, you know, he says that this is depressing for him, not only because what it says about, you know, Telegram, but what it says about his own, you know, ambitions as a tech startup guy, because he wants to develop projects in Russia.
Durov wasn't inspiration for me personally and for my generation as I see it. And it's not so we are glad for Durov and for his service and for Telegram for all he does, but we are sad about our future and our like being in St. Petersburg and understanding that we cannot do big things and create some influential web service or something, some tool that won't be in some way suppressed by the government.
Yeah, so the techies have ambition and they want to thrive.
That's right, Marco. And what happened with Durov's previous company, Vkontakte, which again was taken over by Russian by the Russian government or certainly Russian-friendly oligarchs, and what's happening now with Telegram says that you can't do that.
The World's Charles Main speaking with us from Moscow. Thanks as always, Charles.
Thank you.
I'm guessing most of you have a pretty good image of what a star looks like. But what does a star sound like? Tomorrow, NASA is hoping to launch a mission that might help us out. They're sending out into space a telescope called TESS. The mission, to find previously undetected planets orbiting stars visible to us here on Earth. But TESS won't just be looking at those stars. Here's my BBC colleague, Pallab Ghosh.
TESS will also be listening to the sound of stars. This is what a faraway star similar to our sun would sound like if we could hear it. Of course, there's no air in space, so stars can't actually be heard. But because of the tumultuous processes that cause them to shine, they also vibrate and so generate sound waves. And each star has its own song, characteristic of its age and composition. This is a much larger, older star, and so its sound is lower pitched and rumbling.
When we hear the sounds of the stars, first of all, it tells us that out of this turbulence, this almost chaos, we get these ordered sounds.
Professor Bill Chaplin from Birmingham University is leading the research to analyse star songs.
This gives us a way to actually study stars and see what their insides look like in a way that is just not possible by other means. So it's giving us an unprecedented view of what these stars really are like.
The star songs will tell researchers how hot each star is. They can then see if they have planets around them at just the right distance away to support life. Not too hot and not too cold, but just right in what astronomers call the Goldilocks zone.
That was the BBC science correspondent Pallab Ghosh reporting from Cape Canaveral in Florida. Ultimately, NASA hopes TESS will help reveal any habitable planets that may exist out there in that Goldilocks zone. As I said, the launch is scheduled for tomorrow. And for today, that is our show. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. And, you know, speaking of the Goldilocks zone, why not take a minute tonight to, you know, look up at the stars? We'll be back with you on the radio tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.